I want you to do something for me. Right now, wherever you are, just close your eyes for a second and picture the exact street you grew up on.
Oh, that's a fun exercise.
Right. Just put yourself standing right on the sidewalk, looking down the block. I mean, we always have this like baseline expectation that our memory is going to act like a pristine 4K camera.
Oh, for sure. We definitely assume our brains operate as these high-resolution photographic archives, you know, where every detail is just preserved in perfect objective focus.
Exactly. Like, we assume we can zoom in and see the exact shade of paint on the neighbor's front door or perfectly count the cracks in the driveway. But if you really sit with that image in your head for more than a few seconds, you start to realize the physical proportions are just completely
Yeah,
weird.
they get totally distorted.
They do. The buildings might stretch up way higher than they actually did in reality. Or, you know, the street itself might feel uncomfortably narrow, or maybe the distance to the corner store feels like it spans miles. The physical geometry is entirely warped.
It is. And yet, while the physical geometry of your memory is like completely distorted, the emotional atmosphere of that space remains perfectly mathematically precise.
That is so true.
Right. Like you might not remember the exact height of the fence, but you remember exactly how it felt to stand next to it. Memory rarely functions like an architectural blueprint. It operates as this living, breathing, emotional landscape.
And that tension, that exact tension between physical reality and emotional truth, is exactly where we are heading today.
It's a great topic.
I'm really excited about this one. Our sources for today's deep dive include a really fascinating watercolor painting titled Homes in Chimonongos. It's by the artist Jero Duque, and we also have a technical breakdown of the physical materials he used to create it and an incredible set of personal studio notes written by the artist himself.
It is a really remarkable collection of materials to dive into, because what Duke has done here is he takes this highly specific, tangible, everyday physical space and transforms it into a surreal, profoundly psychological environment.
So our mission today is to unpack exactly how art manages to pull off that magic trick. We are going to explore how this specific piece captures the incredible fragility of memory, the heavy concrete reality of urban architecture, and this is the part that really hooked me from his notes, the profound silent isolation that is so often hidden right in the middle of the most crowded, noisy neighborhoods on earth.
Yeah, that isolation aspect is huge.
Yeah.
But to truly grasp the deep psychology of this artwork, we really have to begin with the physical materials on the artist's desk.
The actual paint and paper.
Exactly. The technical choices Duke made, they actively dictate the emotional weight that you as the viewer end up feeling. It's this journey that takes us from the very tangible reality of pigments straight into a purely interior world.
Looking at the notes, I'm stuck on this technical detail because it just seems so extreme. This piece wasn't even painted on location. It was created in June 2023, sitting in the artist's studio in Whittier, California, which is thousands of miles away from the subject of the painting.
Right, he's very far removed geographically.
But the physical material he painted it on is what really catches my eye. He used Arches paper, specifically 640 gram cold press paper with a coarse grain. I mean, from what I understand, why does a watercolor need to be painted on something as thick as cardboard?
Well, it comes down to the sheer volume of water the artist intends to use and, you know, how he wants the paint to behave. In watercolor, the vehicle for the pigment is water.
Right.
So when you use paper that is this incredibly dense, it allows the artist to literally flood the surface without the page warping or buckling or tearing.
So he is essentially just drowning the page.
Very much.
But there's also a note here that he specifically used Daniel Smith watercolors. For those of us who aren't like art supply aficionados, what is the significance of that specific brand in combination with this heavy paper?
The chemistry of those specific paints is crucial to the final image. A lot of watercolor brands use synthetic dyes, which create these very smooth, uniform washes of color.
Right.
But Daniel Smith watercolors are famous because they are often milled from actual crushed minerals and semi-precious stones.
Wait, really? Actual stones.
Yeah, actual stones. So these are heavy, physical particles of pigment. Now, remember that coarse grain paper you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, the cardboard thick stuff.
Exactly. That means the surface isn't smooth. It is full of these microscopic mountains and valleys.
Oh, I see where this is going. So when you flood that paper with water, those heavy mineral particles must settle completely irregularly.
Bingo.
They drop into those microscopic valleys instead of sitting smoothly on the surface.
They sink and group together in a process called granulation. So when that massive amount of water finally evaporates, the heavy pigments have dried, in a highly irregular, diffuse way. The color literally breaks apart on the page.
That perfectly explains why there are no sharp, hyper-realistic edges in this painting. The paint dries to create what Duke describes in his notes as a visual fog.
A visual fog, exactly.
It reminds me of sitting in a warm car on a freezing winter day, looking at the street through a heavily fogged up window. You can't see the sharp edges of the bricks or the perfect geometry of the streetlights. And because you are deprived of that sharp detail, your brain is forced to stop looking at the trivia of the architecture and focus entirely on the heavy feeling of the space.
That's a really great analogy. Think of it as a fogged window where you can't wipe the condensation away because the condensation is actually baked right into the glass.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The paper and the mineral pigments are actively conspiring to prevent realism. Duke deliberately chose a medium that would create this uncertain, diffuse light, literally swallowing the hard contours of the world.
But this deliberate choice to create a visual fog creates a massive contradiction when you realize what the painting is actually depicting. The inspiration for this artwork is Chimanangos, which is a very real working-class neighborhood in the city of Cali, Colombia.
Right.
It's the exact neighborhood where Duke lived with his parents and siblings during his youth.
So he is attempting to document his own history, his own community.
But this is where the contradiction hits me. I mean, if you know anything about Cali, Colombia, you know it is world famous for being intensely vibrant.
Oh, absolutely.
The weather is tropical. The light is incredibly bright and piercing. It is known globally as the capital of salsa music. It is a city of movement and color. But when you look at this painting, it is completely devoid of that tropical light.
It is very dark.
Right. It is filled with deep, melancholy indigo blues and heavy, oppressive grays. The buildings don't stand up straight. They lean dangerously over the street, folding in on the public space. Why would an artist take such a vivid, colorful reality and drown it in this surreal, heavy gloom? Doesn't that sort of fail to accurately document the reality of his own community?
Well, it seems counterintuitive at first glance, but it raises a profound point about how we process truth in art. The surrealism here is actually significantly sharper and more accurate than realism ever could be.
I'm going to need you to break that down for me. How is a gloomy, warped street more accurate than painting the actual bright reality?
Consider how geographic and temporal distance works on the human mind. If Duke painted a hyper-realistic, brightly colored street corner with perfect architectural perspective, your eye would immediately get caught up in anecdotal details.
Like the trivia we mentioned earlier.
Right. You would evaluate the exact shade of yellow on a parked taxi or try to read the specific lettering on a corner store sign. By washing all of that away in this surreal, heavy fog, he forces you to feel the sheer, invisible weight of the space. In his studio notes, he observes that the facades of these buildings are worn, but not just by the weather. He writes they are worn by time and by life.
By time and by life. That phrase completely changes how you look at a simple wall of concrete.
It really does. It implies that the concrete and the brick are actually porous, that over decades, they literally absorb the exhaustion of the workers, the early morning commutes, the economic anxieties of the families inside, the births, the deaths.
And looking closely at the architecture in the painting, you can really see that weight. The buildings lack mathematical perspective. They don't recede nicely to a vanishing point on the horizon like a classic Renaissance painting.
No, not at all.
They pile up on top of each other. It visually represents what Duke calls an architecture of necessity, which references the reality of Latin American autoconstruction.
Autoconstruction is such a fascinating urban phenomenon. In these working-class communities, neighborhoods aren't born from some master blueprint designed by an urban planner in a downtown office. They grow organically over decades out of sheer, unrelenting necessity.
You can see it in the way the buildings are stacked. Like, a family builds a ground floor out of concrete blocks. They leave the steel rebar sticking out of the roof, just exposed to the elements for 10 years, waiting until they can scrape together enough money to add a second story for a married child.
Yes, exactly.
And then a neighbor extends a concrete balcony out over the sidewalk, practically touching the house across the street.
The best way to understand it is to look at a coral reef.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, a reef isn't planned. It grows organically as generations of organisms build their calcium skeletons directly on top of the generation before them. That is exactly what these buildings are. They form a dense, living organism of cement, exposed brick, and plaster.
And a structure like that, it both embraces the community but also suffocates its inhabitants. That tension, the claustrophobia of these leaning, windowless walls pressing into the street, is what the surreal perspective captures perfectly. It shows you how the physical space dictates the daily human grind, and how that endless grind physically deforms the space right back.
And if these buildings are physically bowing under the weight of decades of history and necessity, we naturally have to look down at the street level to examine the psychology of the people who actually have to hold up those walls every single day.
The figures down on the street level are so striking because of how insignificant they seem against the architecture. They are tiny. Their proportions are completely skewed-like. Some are stretched tall. Others seem compressed. And they are completely faceless.
Yeah, there's no detail on them.
None at all. There are no recognizable portraits of the neighbors Duke grew up with. They don't have eyes or mouths. They just look like smudges of wet charcoal bleeding directly into the gray wash of the street.
They exist merely as symbolic presences. They are waiting or walking or simply standing. Even the street dogs scattered around them are painted as unstable silhouettes, looking as though one more drop of water would wash them away entirely.
Which brings up a glaring contradiction for me. Working class neighborhoods in Latin America are famously defined by their communal vitality. People are living practically on top of each other.
Extremely close quarters.
Right. There is music blasting from open windows, kids playing makeshift soccer in the street, neighbors shouting to each other across narrow alleys. It is defined by constant loud interaction. So why strip all of that away? The most unsettling thing about these figures is that they do not interact with one another at all.
Mm.
Why depict this deeply communal space as completely silent and emotionally isolated?
Because the artist is deliberately revealing an invisible reality that all of that daily noise usually covers up. Duke is making a profound statement about the internal struggle of urban living and the fragility of individual identity. We often conflate physical proximity with emotional connection.
We totally do. We assume that because you are literally sharing a wall with your neighbor, you are deeply connected to them.
Exactly. But the opposite can be true. The painting strips away the noise to capture the internal silence of the individual. Imagine an exhausted worker walking home through those narrow, crowded streets after a grueling 12-hour shift.
Yeah.
Outside, on the street, there's chaos, motorcycles, music, and life. But inside that person's mind, there is a profound, heavy silence. There is immense bone-deep fatigue.
The daily grind just erases your features until you're just a shadow walking down the street. It's a powerful visualization of how terrifyingly easy it is for a person to dissolve entirely into the endless routine of mere survival.
It also serves as a firm rejection of a very common trope. This painting explicitly refuses to be a romanticized, idealized, tourist postcard of poverty.
We see that trope all the time in media and art, don't we? People love to look at working class struggles through this lens of toxic positivity. The narrative is always, look how little they have, but look how happy and resilient and colorful their lives are.
It's very common.
It's a way for outsiders to feel comfortable looking at hardship.
Dirk's work rejects that comfort entirely. It is a compassionate but unflinching look at the deep, silent loneliness that exists within crowded cities. The homage he's paying isn't to the joyful noise of the neighborhood. It's to the monumental, silent resistance of a community surviving an unforgiving environment day in and day out, carrying an invisible weight.
Capturing that kind of raw, unromanticized truth requires a very specific vantage point. I mean, you rarely notice the water you're swimming in until you actually climb out of the pool. The personal motivation behind this piece really hinges on this concept of distance.
The physical and temporal distance from the subject is the key that unlocks the whole piece. Duke recently traveled from California to return and visit this childhood neighborhood in Cali.
Right.
And experiencing the massive transformation of both the people and the physical space over time was a heavy emotional shock for him.
It makes me think of living in an aging house. Over the years, the paint starts peeling in the bathroom, the floorboards start creaking, the front door swells and sticks. But because you live there every single day, your brain normalizes the decay. You stop seeing it.
You have to.
Yeah. If you focused on the peeling paint every single day, you'd be overwhelmed. You just need to get through the day so your brain filters it out.
Your brain creates a necessary mechanism for survival.
Mm-hmm.
But when you move away, that filter of normalization breaks. If you return to that house 10 years later, the decay hits you instantly. You immediately see how much the roof has sagged or how deeply worn the floorboards are.
And that is exactly what happens when you paint from thousands of miles away. Physical distance and the passage of time act as a purifying filter for emotional memory. by migrating away from Columbia, Duke's brain was allowed to drop that survival filter.
Exactly.
When he returned, the contrast was violently clear. He could see how the buildings had aged, and more importantly, how the bodies of the people had physically absorbed those years of hard labor.
So when he sits in his studio in Whittier and lets those heavy mineral pigments bleed across that thick paper, he isn't painting the architectural reality of the streak. He is painting the psychological truth of his memory. The fog of the watercolor strips away the distracting daily chaos to reveal the immense, dignified resistance of a community enduring the implacable passage of time.
It is absolutely incredible how we've gone from talking about the granular physics of heavy watercolor pigments sinking into cold press paper, all the way down into the psychological depths of memory, urban isolation, and human resilience. It fundamentally changes how you view the built environment.
It really does.
It makes you realize that the places we grow up in aren't just collections of asphalt and brick. They are living entities, heavy with the memories of everyone who has ever walked through them.
They are monuments to everyday survival, actively shaped by the people who inhabit them, while simultaneously shaping those people in return.
And that brings us to a final thought, something we want to turn directly over to you, the listener. Because this deep dive into memory, architecture, and isolation shouldn't just end with a watercolor of a neighborhood in Columbia. We want you to think about the spaces you navigate every single day right now. But let's take it a step further than just the physical world. Let's think about the digital neighborhoods we are constantly building.
Oh, that's a great point. The concept of auto-construction applies flawlessly to our digital lives. Think about your social media feeds or the sprawling digital networks you interact with daily.
These digital spaces are the ultimate architecture of necessity. They aren't planned with a clean blueprint. They grow organically, chaotically, layer by layer, as millions of people add their thoughts, their photos, and their digital extensions every single second. It is a massive, overwhelming coral reef made of data and algorithms.
And just like the residents in Duke's painting, we wander through these incredibly dense, hyper-crowded digital streets.
Exactly. We are constantly surrounded by the noise of millions of other people. Yep. But are we actually connecting with them? When you look back at your digital footprint 10 or 20 years from now, how will the filter of time distort it?
That's the real question.
Will you remember genuine human connection and warmth? Or will you realize that our digital avatars are just like the faceless, smudged figures and the watercolor tiny silhouettes wandering through a massive, chaotic architecture, experiencing profound, silent isolation while entirely surrounded by a multitude?
It really challenges us to look closely at whether the spaces we are building, both physical and digital, are facilitating actual connection or just masking our profound loneliness with constant noise.
It's a heavy, fascinating question to carry with you the next time you open your phone or walk out your front door. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the surreal truth of memory. Take a close look at the spaces around you today, and we'll catch you on the next one.